has changed around a bit, and this is the current title, and I will explain it as the talk goes on. I think most people will understand Keynes Redux. I'm referring to the recent revival in discourse about Keynes. But before I go on to talk more about what about this paper itself, let me just give you a bit of background. I can only give you a kind of flavor of the sort of thing I'm doing with Keynes these days, but it does lie at the intersection of three concerns. One is obviously my interest in and desire to say something about the recent Keynes revival, particularly in its international dimension. The second part of the background is that it's connected with some work that I've done, particularly involving looking at nations, nationalism, etc., from a political economy perspective, because I found to my great dissatisfaction that all the discourse about nations and nationalism tended to be cultural, and I found it very problematic, particularly given my experience of growing up in India. I had a very deep sense that they were also economic entities. And so I did a major research project in the course of which we made a historical distinction between developmental nationalism in the immediate post-war period and the more recent cultural nationalism of the neoliberal era. But that gave me a very a certain perspective on attempting to understand the rise of nations within the context of capitalist geopolitics, etc. The final part of the background to this paper is a book I'm writing entitled When Was Globalization? Origin and End of a U.S. Strategy? In which I argue that globalization is one of a series of strategies which the Americans came up with after the during and after the 1970s as an attempt to shore up their hegemony. And in the course of which, of course, I have to talk about what American hegemony slash imperialism meant. And in this context as well, I found myself understanding and having to explain how the role of nation states had been underestimated, generally not fully understood. So, it is in this context, oddly enough, that I found Keynes very relevant. I think you'll see what I mean as I go on. Most immediately, of course, you know that during the G8 summit and so on, there was a lot of talk about a new Bretton Woods, and therefore there is some case for connecting what happened all those years ago, 65 years ago, I suppose now, and what is going on right now. And so that's what I'm going to do. And basically, the subtitle, History Catches Up, refers to the fact that my argument in this paper is that the world that Keynes spoke for was delayed in its birth. Keynes thought it was being born, but in fact, US power, which was enormously heightened in the course of the war and the course of the 30 years crisis, as Ina Meyer dubbed it, was so greatly increased relative to the rest of the world that the international world Keynes spoke for could not come into being. And I'm seeing some possibilities that it might be doing so now, which is what makes Keynes very relevant today. So in the course of making this argument, I'm going to first talk about a bit, very briefly, about the problems with the so-called revival of Keynes today, the return of Mr. Keynes or somebody else, a little bit about the fact that the US dollar's future is in question, something that Prabhat is going to talk about later on Tuesday, by the way, those of you who may not know, at the LSC at 6 o'clock, but I won't go there right now. I then go on to Keynes's defeated proposals. Most people imagine that the Bretton Woods system was Keynesian. It was not. It was based on defeating the most important aspects of Keynes's proposals, so I talk briefly about that. About what I see as the radicalism of Keynes, which is perhaps a little bit of a surprising argument, not least because both Marxists and Keynesians agree that Keynes was a kind of pro-capitalist, anti-Marxist type of economist. I want to then talk about the historical Keynes, which is perhaps even more than the radical Keynes has been more or less entirely overlooked. And then I speak briefly about what I call the afterlife of imperialism, the long and very troubled phase of so-called U.S. hegemony, out of which we might now be emerging, and what that implies for the possibility of recreating or creating the kind of system that Keynes had originally propose a kind of international system of international economic governance. So basically, Alan and I wrote this piece in which we said that a lot of what was passing for the talk about the return of Keynes should actually be called the return of Professor Samuelson, because if you looked at Keynes's own thinking and sort of respected its integrity, there were a number of things that were wrong. The stimulus packages were minuscule compared to what Keynes might have imagined are needed. There's absolutely zilch redistributive element in it. The bailouts seem to be rewards for the very rentiers that Keynes spoke out against, and for the very activities which he most severely criticized. There was a socialization of losses rather than investment. That the crisis, many of these so-called Keynesians that have become sort of economists of the hour, and again, Prabhat talks more about that in his paper on contingent Keynesianism tomorrow, but the crises are treated as episodic rather than systemic to the nature of capitalism. And of course, the discussion about New Bretton Woods, which, funny enough, I mean, Keynes is not so much involved there, perhaps partly because everybody assumes that Keynesian Bretton Woods had failed, and now we have to think perhaps completely anew. It's also the case that, of course, we have been talking a lot about how most economists didn't see it coming, but quite a lot of critical writers, well before the onset of the crisis, well before there was any hint of a crisis, were raising questions about the imbalances, what it implied for the future of the dollar. And I've just listed a few that came off the top of my head: George, Susan George, George Monbiot, Joseph Stiglitz, Giovanni Arrighi. All these people had raised issues about the imbalances and how long the dollar's role as the world's currency could be preserved or could last. And of course, immediately as the crisis broke, of course, the value of the dollar shot up because everybody rushed the dollar for safety. But it seems to be, and of course, this was helped by the fact that everybody who was holding dollars, such as China, etc., also had some interest in at least not allowing its value to drop catastrophically. So there was that element. Nevertheless, how long the dollar can remain international reserve currency is, world currency is an issue. We know, of course, that the Chinese government has proposed a series of alternatives, or proposed an alternative. I was recently reading that the Japanese Democratic Party, which is expected by many observers to be the winner of the next election to come in fall, is basically preparing proposals such that if the United States wants liquidity, it will have to buy it in yen rather than dollars, which will change the whole situation of the and the Japanese will not be so dependent on the value of the dollar anymore. So these are all signs that the future of the dollar is radically in question. And of course, there is also the UN Commission of Experts on reform of the international financial and monetary system. Now, if you look at the defeated proposals, this is a picture most of you, or many of you, might recognize as Keynes and Harry Dexter White. Most people think that it was Harry White's proposals that defeated Keynes's proposals, if they are even aware that Keynes's were defeated. But of course, actually, Harry White and Keynes agreed about a great deal, and what defeated both White and Keynes at some level was sheer United States obstinacy about this. But I can't go into that in great detail. But basically, if we review what Keynes wanted, he wanted capital controls. He wanted a truly international currency rather than the currency of any particular country, masquerading as an international currency. He dubbed it the Bancor. He wanted a system of international payments in which there would be creditor responsibility as well as debtor responsibility, and a system of international trade in which there would be surplus country responsibility as well as a deficit country responsibility. He wanted, therefore, the entire system to be geared towards discouraging trade imbalances from mounting. The simple way of doing that he devised was simply to make the accumulation of surpluses less attractive. It would simply not pay you to accumulate surpluses if you were the government of any country. And of course, what Bretton Woods did was it nixed all the proposals except capital controls. And even they, of course, went out the window starting in the late 1970s, so that what you had, people often distinguish between Bretton Woods 1, which was roughly lasted from 1945 to 1971, when the United States broke the dollar's link with gold, which was supposed to be the linchpin of the system, and then was, we are told, the dawn of a new Bretton Woods II, which was praised for its flexibility, and so it was going to last forever, and this would be fine, etc. But in fact, not only was Bretton Woods I not what Keynes wanted, Bretton Woods II was practically in all respects the opposite of what Keynes wanted. Not only you did not have capital controls, you had an international currency, which was a sort of pure a dollar standard world currency, zero creditor responsibility, zero surplus country responsibility, a huge incentive for the capital rich and more efficient countries to accumulate both capital and trade surpluses, etc. So, I mean, in every respect, Keynes would have opposed what we've had since 1971. Now, I just want to say a few things about where Keynes' proposals came from, in a sense. I think that many people dismiss many people would dismiss the idea that Keynes was at all radical. He himself made a number of statements which clearly dismissed Marxism, Marx's writing, Capital, etc. However, I think that there are important overlaps and parallels, and I can't go into great detail, but actually also important intellectual connections between Marx and Keynes. But let me just give you a flavor of this, of the way in which I think about this relationship. So both basically Marx and Keynes, I begin from the fact that both Marx and Keynes were critics of the classical political economy. They each inherited, in Keynes's case, coming many years later. Indeed, Keynes was born, I think, about 3 months after Marx died. In Keynes's case, including what we today call neoclassical or marginalist economics. So where these thinkers took the level of economic activity and employment as a given, Keynes took it as his chief exponendum. Where they assumed away the problem of unemployment, he made solving it his chief policy priority. Where they regarded saving virtuous to be rewarded with interest, he criticized it as the vice of the functionless investor to be discouraged by driving interest rates near zero and keeping them there, euthanizing the rentier. Where they loathed and feared state intervention, he advocated its use up to and including the socialization of investment to achieve full employment. And by the way, I attended a talk given by Robert Schiller of the famous Case-Shiller Index, and Will Hutton of The Guardian was hosting it. And since Schiller began his talk with a kind of grand flourish of, you know, invoking Keynes, I sort of said, well, were you aware that, you know, Keynes advocated socialization of investment in many of the things you're saying, seemed to go against that idea? And first of all, Schiller seemed completely disbelieving that Keynes had recommended anything of the sort. Then Hutton came to his rescue saying, oh, he just says that in one sentence at the end of the general theory. I would argue that this is more than just an isolated sentence. Two sentences. Did you say I have 2 minutes?
Two minutes.
Okay. Quickly then. They opposed protectionism. Keynes advocated a national economy. They pursued efficiency single-mindedly. He quietly insisted on sufficiency, something that Vicky talked about yesterday. We'll probably talk more about today. Victoria Trick, I mean. And where they worshipped at the altar of the supposedly neutral gold standard, Keynes exposed the historical conditions which made it appear neutral. It was never neutral. and the political conditions in which it became acceptable for a short time. Now, I have only two. I think I need more like five. Is that all right? I'll quickly rush
yes.
through.
Okay.
So, historically, I just want to, I'll just underline what I think is a very important point, which I don't think, I mean, I've not really read anybody who's emphasized this, although that may just be the limitations of my own reading. But I would class Keynes as part of the general migration of a number of British intellectuals from the liberal stream to a kind, a form of social liberalism that merged into social democracy. And this is very well documented by Peter Clark in his book, Liberals and Social Democrats, which is a very helpful read, I think, to understand the intellectual temper of these folks. Which was stimulated by the dissatisfaction with 19th century liberalism and the fact that, in fact, it could not deliver on its promises. And it's important for us to remember that, so that even if you weren't inclined to be a Marxist and go and march with the ragged rabble in working class marches about jobs or hunger or whatever, you could see intellectually that there was something wrong. Okay. At the same time, these people were witness to something which I would argue that in a certain respect, at least, Marx was not. Marx wrote at a time at the high noon of British Empire. By the end of the 19th century, what you had was a very complex and messy and odd, apparently odd to 19th century cosmopolitan liberals, odd emergence of national economies, which of course in the writing of Booker and Hilferding, etc., were also imperial economies, the strong national economies. They fought for industrial advantage, and in the fight for industrial advantage against England's dominance, they also felt that they needed colonies, which is what imperial competition was all about. So it was an inter-imperial competition, but of course it was first and foremost a national, international competition. This is also the age of the maturation of Polanyi's double movement, thanks to the emergence of mass politics, popular social forces which emerge, which effectively impose upon the state, either because of straightforward working class demand or state fears about the consequences of not acting to preempt those demands, an era of social protection, however we may laud it or criticize it, but this is in fact what was happening. And therefore Keynes was a thinker, probably there were many, who was not subject to a kind of cosmopolitan bias of the 19th century thinking about economics, which in many ways is still persists, and indeed understood that working class and the stickiness of wages, etc., had something to do with why the gold standard, for instance, had become inoperable, an idea that Eichengreen elaborates in his Golden Fetters. He also launches basically a new discipline of economics, macroeconomics. People did not study national economic aggregates before. This is in a sense, kind of nationalization of economics. And Galbraith argues that he also the fact that national income accounting, which was created, was based on Keynes's ideas, was extremely consequential. Consider just the following. Until well into the Depression, Galbraith says, the United States had no useful figures on the level or distribution of employment. There was a certain classical logic to this. One did not spend money collecting information on what, in high economic neoclassical principle, could not exist. But once national accounting existed, it actually changes the very way in which we perceive the economy. National income showed the value of total production of goods and services of all kinds, public and private, gross national product. And in companion tables, they showed the income derived therefrom by kind and source, national income. That the latter needed to be sufficient to buy the former was a thought that no one could henceforth escape. Nor, more specifically, the thought that savings from the income now shown might not all be used, that they might not be absorbed by the spending for investment goods also shown in the tables. And it was evident how serviceably an increment of income, as from government expenditure, would make up any shortfall in investment spending or consumer borrowing and add to the purchase of and production of goods. So, in a sense, and this is also interesting because no matter that, We've had neoliberalism for 30 years. Some sense that governments were responsible for maintaining certain levels of government economic activity has not gone away. Hence, credit Keynesianism, military Keynesianism, etc., etc.
You've now got 1 minute in your own terms.
Okay. So basically, and I also make the point that historically, while many people have correctly pointed out that Keynes was not exactly, his heart didn't exactly bleed for the poor masses of the Third World, etc., etc., the fact that in 1944 at Bretton Woods he spoke for a country he knew was devastated by the war, that would not be in a high competitive position, that was about to lose her empire, made his recommendations a lot more relevant to what Third World countries wanted. It was this. I'm not going to argue about Keynes's conscience. That's up to him. It's not my business. So I just want to say the following very quickly. Keynes actually was not defeated by White. In fact, he was defeated by US power. And from Skidelsky's biography, Skidelsky points out that the agreement was not shaped by Keynes's proposals, but if there was an underlying ideology, he says, it was Morgenthau's determination to concentrate financial power in Washington. Keynes himself said, the Americans at the top, he came away very, very disappointed. They have no conception of international cooperation. Since they are the biggest partners, they think they have the right to call the tune on practically every point. If they knew the music, it wouldn't matter, but they don't. So basically, the war increased U.S. power massively. The U.S. basically acted as a vast production machine supplying war material to the countries that actually did the fighting. And at the same time, they were in turn devastated. So in fact, the U.S., it is basically the U.S. uses this moment of artificially increased power to say it's going to be hegemonic, its currency is going to be the world's currency, etc. It was, in fact, never a viable arrangement. In the 1950s, people complained about the dollar shortage, and I can't go into great detail about this. By the 1960s, once you got convertibility of other currencies, there was a dollar glut, the so-called Triffin dilemma, wherein if the United States increased the supply of dollars by incurring payments deficit, the value of the dollar fell and nobody wanted to hold it anymore. Which, of course, somebody mentioned De Gaulle in one of the earlier sessions.
We've had
23
minutes.
Okay. All right. So, none of this. I mean, you had 70s, it didn't work. 80s, you had high interest rates. 90s, you had Greenspan's stock market bubble, etc. They have needed all these devices to keep the dollar is the world's currency, and so all I'm trying to say is that we are now in a world where there is at least a much larger number of countries that are quite influential who will have an interest in creating an international system of payments. G20 isn't G92, but it sure as hell is better than G8, which always effectively meant G1 until now. Sorry about that.
No,
sorry to my other speakers as well. There you go.